Women Worldwide with Deirdre Breckenridge introduces incredible stories shared by women across the globe who have experienced the great heights of success and, at times, the agony of defeat. With a vision to impart wisdom and advice on how to tackle barriers and soar to new heights, the show uncovers different perspectives to help you find your inner strength and to power up your own voice so you can excel in life.
Hi, everyone. I'm Deirdre Breckenridge. Thanks for tuning into Women Worldwide. All right. Most of you are in business or you're working for somebody else, and every single day you're facing decisions. But you know what? When times are tough and you're faced with really challenging situations that could damage your reputation and your bottom line, let me ask you this question. Are you mentally ready for that kind of decision making? Well, this is really important to think about because you don't want to worry about it when crisis strikes. And I guess you realize this is me leading up to my very special guest today. Joining me on the show is Helio Fred Garcia. He is the author of the book, The Agony of Decision, Mental Readiness and Leadership in a Crisis. Fred is also a professor at Columbia Engineering, and he's at the Stern School of Business at NYU. He is also the president of Logos Consulting Group. I really could go on and on about Fred because he has done so much, but we're going to dive into his story. And Fred, it's great to have you on the show. Welcome.
Great to be with you, Deirdre. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so of course, knowing you for a while, you've come over to the U.S. from Brazil, and you carved a career path to become an author, a professor. You founded Logos Consulting Group. You are the president. Tell us a little bit about your journey and maybe some of the special people who propelled you to get you to where you are today.
Well, thank you. I guess my journey is what you might call a typical American immigrant journey. I got to this country from Brazil when I was six. I actually arrived the week before first grade, and I didn't speak a word of English, and my mom didn't speak a word of English. My dad spoke fluent English, and he was a professor of languages at a college. But my first day of school, I couldn't understand what was going on, and the teachers just concluded that I was dumb.
Oh, gosh.
Because of my appearance, I have fair skin and blue eyes and then had blonde hair. And they didn't see me as sort of the typical Latin American immigrant. And they just assumed that I was just a dumb kid. And so they treated me as the dumb kid for 5 years. And I ended up going to school every day and not learning very much. And at home, we spoke Portuguese, and I didn't know what school was supposed to be like. But then in sixth grade, a very special teacher took me aside on the first day and asked me a bunch of questions. And I have a vivid memory of her just smiling and beaming and her chin lifting up to the sky. And she let out a deep breath and she said, "My son, you're not stupid. You don't speak English." And she realized that for 5 years, I hadn't failed in school. The school had failed me. And she made me her project. And so for an entire year, I stayed after school for 90 minutes every day. And we caught up with all the English I hadn't learned. And then she had me begin to memorize public documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Gettysburg Address. She had me speak in the front of the room. She had me do elocution. She had me recite so that every syllable could be heard in the back of the room. She had me put marbles in my mouth and do it again so she could hear every syllable. And by the end of that year, I was not only caught up, I was way ahead of my classmates. And to the point, that was sixth grade. But by seventh grade, they decided to have me skip eighth grade. And I went right to high school, joined a debating team, became a debate and speech competitor. One thing led to another. By the time I was 17, I was working in the House of Representatives as a page during Watergate summer, and I got to sit in the back of the Judiciary Committee watching people like American Congresswoman Barbara Jordan talk about how no president is above the law. And I got goosebumps doing that. I mean, here's this immigrant kid who 5 years earlier couldn't speak And suddenly I was an eyewitness to history and watching a change of government. And I have a vivid memory when President Nixon resigned. I waited for the planes in the sky and the tanks in the street, and they didn't come. And I thought, wow, a change of government of a corrupt presidency without soldiers in the street. I want to be part of this. So I went to college to study political science. I ended up getting a degree in political science and also in philosophy. I then went to graduate school at Columbia University. I studied ancient Greek philosophy and ancient Greek rhetoric. And before I knew it, I was an adult and I pass as an American. And in many ways, I'm fortunate because I have the privilege of not appearing the way the stereotype of some immigrants is sometimes portrayed in the media. But I consider myself, I'm an American citizen, but I consider myself an immigrant. My immigrant identity is a big part of who I am. And a lot of what I do is based on the feeling of helplessness as a kid and the recognition that one individual could rescue me and put me on a path. And I've spent the better part of the last 38 years of my career helping people in adversity get past that adversity by harnessing the strength within them. But all it takes sometimes is one person to take the initiative to hold someone's hand and take them to the next level. And you know, a lot of what I've been doing in my career is essentially giving back to that special teacher and other special teachers I've had along the way.
Well, it certainly shows in your career, and it is fascinating, your journey. I love how one special teacher was a mentor, a champion, and helped you to move forward. It's that moment that changed everything else along your path.
It was the transformative experience in my life. And I've had two or three other teachers who've been similarly transformative, but not from a rescue. But I was doing just fine, and they took me to the next level. But that one teacher in 1967 is the one who really turned me around.
Truly amazing. And Here you are now.
Yeah, here I am. You are
doing a lot. And I would love to pivot to your book, the most recent one. I do want to mention that I read The Power of Communication, I think it was back in 2012, which I still reference. That was an excellent book. But was it last summer or?
July of 17, okay. The Agony of Decision was published.
Yeah. So The Agony of Decision, Mental Readiness and Leadership in a Crisis. How did you get started as an author? Before we even get into what the book is about, how did you take that path?
Well, the first thing to note is my dad was a college professor. He was a linguist and a literary critic and a language professor. And he wrote a dozen books in the course of his career. He died young at 56, but from the time he was 30 to the time he was 56, he had written a dozen books and hundreds of articles for scholarly journals. So I grew up in a household where the typewriter was clacking away all the time. Once I was confident in English, once I was in graduate school, I didn't have any issue with writing. It came naturally to me once I understood how to be coherent in the language. But I had done graduate work in ancient Greek philosophy, and I was 5 or 6 years towards a doctorate that I've never completed because I had fights with my advisors and then ran out of money. I got into the world of consulting because there was a big crisis involving an ethical lapse in an industry, and the industry had become discredited. And almost in desperation, the industry association was trying to introduce an ethics program, and they couldn't find people in their industry that were confident they could do an ethics program well. So they, you know, almost in desperation said, well, find me a philosopher and I'll teach him the business. And so I was hired to create an ethics program for this discredited industry. And to their credit, they didn't want to put a veneer on it. They wanted to actually change behavior.
Oh, that's good.
So I spent 2 years developing this ethics training program, developed the curriculum, trained the trainers. They went out into the world, and that industry is now a highly respected, deeply successful industry, not because of what I did, but because of what they did. But that essentially sparked the flame of, wow, I could actually apply the stuff I learned in graduate school that seemed really abstract into changing systems and changing people to take something that was discredited and make it respected again. And I started working in the world of finance, trying to deal with scandals on Wall Street and dealing with scandals in corporations and scandals in healthcare. And over the time, that evolved. I joined the NYU faculty 30 years ago. I just finished my 30th year.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. On the New York University faculty. And I started writing a book back then that I never finished, but parts of which I have embedded into other books. And that was on how to build trust and how to inspire confidence. And most of the books I've written now, I've written four so far. I've got a fifth on the way, which is my personal story. And I've got a sixth on the way, which is a history of Edward L. Bernays, the founder of public relations, who actually figured out how to change systems and how to restore trust and how to restore confidence. And his 100th anniversary of teaching the first course in public relations at NYU is coming up. The 100th anniversary of his book, Crystallizing Public Opinion, is coming up. And I'm timing my biography of him to coincide with his anniversary.
Oh, that's excellent. I'll be reading that book.
Well, thank you. So what I started to do is I was studying trust and studying patterns of corporate behavior and of stakeholder behaviors, I started to notice repetitive patterns that you could see again and again and again. And I discovered that there are certain things that never work and certain things that always work. And remarkably, companies and institutions and universities and religious organizations and governments who find themselves under stress, as a first resort, do the things that we know never work and fail to do the things that we know do work. And so part of my writing, my first book was called Crisis Communication 20 years ago. My second book was Reputation Management with my NYU colleague, John Doerly. That's now going into its fourth edition.
Oh, I read that book.
Yeah. And my third book was The Power of Communication and now The Agony of Decision. And what all of them have in common is I attempt to systematize common sense. And one of the things I find is that leaders of institutions are reluctant to follow common sense because they don't necessarily recognize it. But if you can systematize it and say, hey, there's a 5-step process for being forgiven. Hey, there's a 7-step process for restoring trust. They say, oh, really? Tell me what they are. And so I systematize the common sense and I illustrate that common sense with examples. And I found a number of things. One, the writing forced me to think more clearly. Because you know, as a teacher, Deirdre, that if you have to explain something to people who don't know anything about it, you have to really understand it and get down to the essence of it. And then if you have to convey that understanding to people whom you can't even see, it has to be even clearer. So I find that the process of writing forces me to break things down to the simplest principles and then amplify those principles with recognizable illustrations. And whether I'm telling a story in front of a classroom or speaking in front of people at a conference or writing the book, I try to do the same thing. And that is break things down to the elementary principles that everyone can understand and then put them together in a way that people feel empowered to do. And then use the examples as ways to give themselves permission to do something that may feel unnatural. So, for example, if people have been hurt, the longer it takes to apologize, the less likely you are to be forgiven. So if I can break down the idea of victimhood and I can break down the idea of forgiveness and I can break down the steps of an effective apology and then show how to put all of those steps together in a timely way and show that if you're going to have to apologize on day 10 and get none of the benefit for it, you might as well apologize on day one and get the benefit of it.
Exactly.
And you know, another pattern that I find is the longer it takes to do what people would expect a responsible organization to do, the more you are losing trust. And it's much harder to restore trust once it has been lost than to maintain trust before it has been lost. And the way I sometimes say that to corporate executives is you get a much higher return on investment in maintaining trust than in having to restore trust. And it may be painful to apologize early. It may be painful to acknowledge your mistakes early, but you're going to have to acknowledge anyway.
Might as well
you're
going
to have
sooner.
To apologize anyway. So why not do it in a way that gets you some benefit? And that is, the sooner you are seen to do the responsible thing, the sooner people say, okay, they're okay, and they turn their attention elsewhere. But the longer it takes to do the responsible thing, the harder it is to get people to actually trust you afterwards. So whether it's corporations or religious organizations or governments, the pattern is the same. And what I do is work with clients and work with students to help them understand the relationship between timeliness and effectiveness. An ineffective response in a timely way makes matters worse. An effective response in a timely way resolves the crisis and trust doesn't go down. And what I tried to do in the Agony of Decision book is give people a way of understanding decision making so that they can make as many decisions in advance of the crisis as possible, so that in the moment of crisis, they know how to choose. So the Agony of Decision is about the way to think about decision making. And it establishes specific decision criteria that you can get buy off in advance of something going wrong. And then you simply apply those decision criteria to the circumstance. And what I find is if you apply the right criteria in the circumstance, you can have a productive list of options that will resolve the crisis in less than 5 minutes. But if you fail to use the right decision criteria, you end up making matters worse and worse and worse. And by the time you get around to using the right criteria, you're trying to clean up a really horrible mess rather than preserving the trust that already exists.
And what I noticed, Fred, what you pointed out in the book is that often leaders don't even see the real problem. They're not looking at the underlying problem. And if you don't get to the root of that problem, then that your communication certainly isn't going to be effective. And just one thing I want to mention before I ask another question, and I have so many questions, but every book I've ever read of yours, I walk away saying, it's so easy.
Yeah.
So you really do.
Well, thank you. That's the highest praise I can receive from you.
Yeah. That's great. Well, you deserve the praise because you really do break it down in a manner that you step away and say, my gosh, why couldn't somebody see this? Why can't leaders see this as they're going through it? Now, in your book, when you talk about mental readiness, it broke down into three parts, and I just want you to kind of tackle them as much as you can. It was deep knowledge, emotional discipline, and intellectual rigor. So maybe you can give the highlights.
Yeah. So when we think about readiness, there are two forms of readiness. One is mental readiness, and the other is operational readiness. Most organizations have some kind of operational readiness. They just don't know when to trigger it. Mental readiness is an attribute of leadership. And as you point out, it comes down to three things. And I do them in this order. It starts with emotional discipline. And emotional discipline consists of a number of things. One of the things it consists of is the ability to contain the panic and the anxiety and the fear that happens in the moment of crisis. And there are a number of ways to do that. One way to do it is to simply drill and prepare and train so that you can contain it, much the way firefighters walk calmly into a burning building, because they've been trained through repetition and understanding of how to get through the fire successfully. And executives can do the same things, and leaders in all forms of enterprise can do the same thing. Another element of mental discipline is recognizing how easy it is to go into denial. And you've mentioned that denial. One of the common patterns we find is executives tend to rationalize away the problem until it's too late. And one of the disciplines I teach my clients and my students is we can't use euphemism. We have to name the problem. The problem isn't the New York Times says our plant is poisoning people. The problem is our plant is poisoning
people. Yes.
And so we have to name the problem with clarity in order to be able to resolve the problem well. So that's the second element of emotional discipline. The third is we need at least a little humility in order to appreciate how others are likely to interpret the crisis. And when we see celebrated failures of really smart people running really successful institutions that crash and burn, it's because of arrogance at the top. So one of the things I do in the book is I point to different experts on humility, whether it's emotional intelligence guru Daniel Goleman or Good to Great author Jim Collins. I even point to a TED talk by the Pope, by Pope Francis, who says that power without humility is self-destructive and causes you and your institution to suffer mightily. So those are the three elements of emotional discipline. Deep knowledge is a combination of recognizing the patterns of organizational behavior and of stakeholder behavior and understanding that things are predictable. So for example, there are patterns that tell us what never works. So delaying doesn't work. Trying to blame others doesn't work. Trying to diminish the significance of the problem doesn't work. Thinking that you have a communication problem rather than a business problem doesn't work. But those typically are the first resort of leaders in companies that don't have the discipline to look at the problem clearly. But we need to recognize the pattern so that we don't repeat those behaviors. We also have a pattern of things that always work. Showing you care always works. And there are certain things that work situationally, and we need to know which situations certain things will work and which situations will not. We can also study individual crises and individual leaders who get through crises well in order to give ourselves permission to do things that feel a little risky in the moment, but to see that other people have done it to good effect. The third element of mental readiness is what I call intellectual rigor. And crisis management is a management process just like every other management process, and management requires rigor. And there is a rigor to making choices in a crisis, and one of the rigors of making choices in a crisis is we resist the temptation to ask certain kinds of questions until we've asked prior questions. So, for example, we resist the temptation to ask, what should we do? Until we've asked, well, what is the circumstance and what are the risks that this circumstance represents? And what is our desired outcome given the risks that this circumstance presents? And then finally, who matters to us and what would they expect a responsible organization to do? And when we've asked those questions, the solution becomes pretty clear pretty quickly. But if we fail to ask those questions, we'll end up impulsively firing this approach or that approach or this other approach, and it's a game of whack-a-mole rather than a systematic attempt to maintain or restore trust and confidence. So those are the three elements of mental readiness: emotional discipline, deep knowledge, and intellectual rigor.
Excellent. Fred, you break this down. When you look at all those three parts together, and if you can apply this, you're so much better off as a leader, and it's good to be understanding this now. And because when it's happening, there's just no way to be able to parse this out. So I really think you have to think about it and look at past incident to understand maybe where you weren't mentally ready. But I'm just going to ask you to hold your thoughts just for a moment. We're going to go to a super quick break to give some love to our sponsor. I also want to mention that Women Worldwide is on the C-Suite Radio Network, and you can find all of our shows at c-suiteradio.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the other great business podcasts as well.
You have been listening to Women Worldwide with your host, Deirdre Breckenridge. Segment 2 is coming right up.
Creating brand loyalty requires a unique blend of strategic communication and innovative technology. Pure Performance Communications works with businesses to move their audiences from awareness to action and impact by offering a digital marketing roadmap. Let us help you foster deeper engagement and forge stronger relationships along the way. Visit us at pureperformancecom.com. That's pureperformancecom with 2 M's.com.
Now, back to Women Worldwide with your host, Deirdre Breckenridge.
I'm Deirdre Breckenridge. Welcome back to the show. Helio Fred Garcia and I were just chatting about his book, The Agony of Decision, Mental Readiness and Leadership in a Crisis. And Fred, you were just going over the whole sort of mental readiness and the different parts where you talked about emotional discipline, deep knowledge, and intellectual rigor. And, you know, we were talking about leaders and identifying the problem, effective communication. You also said that there are severe consequences if you're not mentally ready. As you were doing your research around the book, was there anything that kind of surprised you with some of the companies or situations that you just didn't expect?
It was less a surprise than a continued fascination with smart people making bad choices. And one of the things we find is the business world is littered with really smart leaders of really successful companies who make a really bad choice in a critical moment, and their reputation is ruined and the company suffers a lot. So for example, not to pick on any particular company, but the CEO of BP so mishandled the response to the Deepwater Horizon that not only was he discredited and had to leave, but 8 years later, the stock is still below where it was at the time of the incident, as the stock market has nearly tripled in that time and as other oil companies have nearly doubled in that time. So there's an example of really poor decision-making that alienated people, and that alienation cost the company not only hundreds of billions of dollars of market capitalization, but more than $100 billion of costs associated with penalties, fines, cleanups, settlements, et cetera. And we see company after company run by really smart people making bad choices. One reason is arrogance, and that points to the need for emotional discipline and with some humility in there. But another reason is that human beings under stress aren't good at making decisions. And so the key to these three elements of mental readiness is to make decisions in advance of the crisis. Mm-hmm. And to agree in advance, if a crisis comes, here's how we will evaluate it, and here are the criteria we'll use to decide what to do. And let me just point to the two biggest mistakes that leaders of all forms of organization make in the early moments of the crisis, because they are under stress and the amygdala in the limbic part of the brain hijacks the prefrontal cortex. We just don't think well. In some distress, they will ask some version of one of these two questions. They will ask either, what should we do? Or they will ask, what should we say? The second one is even worse than the first one.
Right.
But with both what should we do and what should we say leads to is a self-referential list of options. So if you ask, what should we do? Someone will say, boss, we should do this. And you say, you're right, we can do that. Well, we could do this. Yeah, we can do that. We could do this. Yeah, we can do that. If you ask, what should we say? Well, boss, we can say this. Well, yeah, we can say that. We should say this. Yeah, we can say that. And that leads to decisions that are self-protective and that don't actually restore trust. So again, not to pick on any one company, but it's a vivid example. One of the things that the CEO of BP said in the aftermath of this big explosion, when everyone was looking at them and asking, what are you going to do about this? He said, well, look, the Gulf of Mexico is a very big ocean. And however much of this stuff is coming out of the bottom of the ocean is tiny with respect to the size of the ocean. Well, that may be a true statement statistically, but it infuriated people. But it's the kind of thing you get when you ask, well, what should we say? Well, boss, tell them it's a big ocean.
Yeah.
Well, you're right. It is a big ocean. So,
but not
so
the right thing to say.
But it's not the right thing to say. And in fact, that just made matters worse. But it's the kind of thing we say under stress when we're trying to make ourselves feel less bad. And the intellectual and emotional discipline is to resist the temptation to make judgments based on how we feel about them. And part of the discipline of the book is we have to take personal preference out of the decision making. And if we allow the CEO to say, I prefer this path, we're going to fail. So we need to take personal preference out. And we need to have agreement in advance that in the event of an incident that threatens trust, here's the criteria we'll use. And let me just share the criteria. Because the goal in the crisis is to maintain trust, and because trust is a consequence of expectations that are fulfilled and promises that are kept and stated values that are lived, the way to make decisions in a crisis is to ask about those who matter to you. What would reasonable people appropriately expect a responsible organization or leader to do when facing this kind of crisis? We don't ask, what should we do? What should we say? We ask, thinking about those who matter to us, what would reasonable people among them expect a responsible company to do? And you get a completely different set of options then. And if we have the discipline to agree on that criterion in advance, we end up making constructive decisions. So here's an example. Assume there's a plane crash. Reasonable people don't appropriately expect a responsible airline to know in the moment of crash what caused the crash. Now, the media will ask and social media will speculate, but trust won't fall just because the company doesn't declare that they know the cause of the crash, because we don't expect them to. We do expect them to acknowledge the crash, to express concern about the people who were on the plane and anybody on the ground, to commit to working with investigators to get to the bottom of it, to take care of the family members who are worried, and to find some way to keep them informed. There's a bunch of expectations we can inventory. And once we understand those expectations, we can then begin to ask, do we have the resources to actually meet these expectations? And if we can, let's do it. And if we can't, we have to reset those expectations. But if we make our decisions based on the appropriate expectations of stakeholders, we end up avoiding saying things like, I'd like my life back, right, which is what Mr. Hayward said. Or in the case of United Airlines CEO Oscar Munoz, when the passenger was horribly beaten, taken off, yes, of a plane, he broke his nose and two teeth and got a concussion and was dragged semi-conscious off the plane. The next day, the CEO of United, in a tweet signed by him, says, I apologize for having to, by the way, apologize for having to is not the same as apologizing for doing something. But what it is that he had to, I apologize for having to reaccommodate the passengers. And as soon as he said reaccommodate, the whole social media world went crazy, and the mainstream media world went crazy, and the late night comedians had a field day with that. And it wasn't until the next day that the CEO had a second statement. And the second statement, he said, what happened on that plane was horrible. No human being should be treated that way. I apologize deeply and profoundly to the passenger who was so mistreated and to the other passengers. Now, if he had said that the first day, United might have gotten through that well.
Exactly. There's almost a defensiveness in the first statement, in a sense that you think you're looking out for your own employees, or did they not fully know the situation, or having to apologize, you know, to not get that wording correctly, or to even understand what your customers are looking for, which is a right, deep, sincere apology.
And what's interesting is the first sentence of the first tweet was, this was a bad day for United. I apologize for having to reaccommodate the passengers. But that's precisely what happens when you get into a self-referential and self-protective frame.
Right.
And so the discipline is to not get into that self-protective frame, but say, this isn't about us. This is about them. This is about the victims and those who are affected by the crisis. Now, it may be that it's our employees as well, and we have to be really thoughtful about protecting our employees as well. But we can't protect our employees at the expense of our customers, because without our customers, the employees don't have a job.
Exactly.
So it's really important to have the discipline to ask, who are the stakeholders who matter, and to inventory them. Because if all you're doing is trying to protect your employees from criticism, you're going to alienate the other stakeholders, including investors. By the way, United just crashed that day. The United stock crashed that day because investors said, whoa, what's going on here? So what all of this points to is really smart people not having the discipline or the rigor to be as thoughtful in crisis as they are in every other part of their work. And one of the things I say to my clients and to my students is, you are rigorous in every single process you deploy at work until it comes time to maintain the trust of the people who matter to you in a crisis. And then you make it up as you go along. And I can't for the life of me understand how in the single most important moment in your career, you would drop the rigor that you use in every other part of your career.
Yeah, you make so many important points. You know, you mentioned social media, which really has changed the way companies are communicating and the transparency that they need. So are most companies generally waking up to understand how social media plays a part of their crisis and a very highly digitized and involved public?
I think in the last 5 years, leaders have come to a deeper recognition that something has changed. And what I actually teach in my crisis management courses and sometimes to my clients is, forget about the particulars of social media. Forget about whether it's Twitter or Facebook or Weibo or WeChat or whatever. What social media has done is fundamentally changed the power dynamic between institutions and individuals. And, so think about this. A single FedEx delivery gone bad. In the world before social media, somebody would have called customer service and complained, and they might have gotten a refund or some settlement. But a few years ago, a guy comes home from work and he looks at his security camera and security monitor in his kitchen, and he sees that a FedEx guy delivering a big Samsung flat screen TV had thrown the TV over the fence to the house, and it was damaged. And he called FedEx and said, "Hey, you damaged my TV, and I've got video showing it." And he didn't have a good reaction from the customer service guy, so he put it on YouTube.
Right.
Within 3 days, the head of North American operations was on YouTube apologizing and saying, "We've changed our procedures. We've changed our training." That is a huge power shift.
Yes.
That one individual customer had the ability to change the training and the work process of a major company. And we see that again and again and again, not only in the United States, but around the world. And so power is shifting from institutions to individuals. And now individuals who've never met create communities to put pressure on institutions. And social media just amplifies that and accelerates that. You know, back during the Tiananmen Square uprising, the technology at the time was fax machines. And people here in the United States watching this happening in Tiananmen Square in Beijing said, "Oh, this is the first fax revolution." We saw in Iran several years ago what was defined as the first Twitter revolution, when there was a change of government and everybody was tweeting in order to coordinate the activities. But now we have, through change.org and through Facebook groups and hashtags, we create communities in social media to put pressure on institutions to express their displeasure with what the institutions are doing or seem to be doing. And institutions are only now beginning to wake up to the fact, not only is it negative visibility, but it's a real power shift. And we need to take that power shift very seriously.
Exactly. And, you know, with a power shift, you could also, if you do the right thing, and if you're, truly understanding how your customer feels and you've gained that trust, you would see a lot more positive through through the shift on social media.
And one of the things we find is when there's an initial outburst on social media and the company immediately does a responsible thing, the people who've been critics turn around and become allies. Say, "Hey, look at what they just did. That's really good. I wonder if other companies in this industry can do something similar." We see that again and again and again.
Right. And this is such a... companies have to take it seriously. It's more than just food for thought. I'm just curious, with all the success and what you're doing in your career, and you have a lot of ahead of you, those two books, yep. I'll certainly be reading whatever you're doing.
Yep.
Was there any piece of advice that someone has given you that sort of stuck throughout your career?
Yeah. Thank you for asking that. Early in my career, a very wise headhunter was trying to get me to take this the job I mentioned, which was to create an ethics program. But it was for a financial industry, and I had no background in finance or in business. And he said, let me give you some career advice. And it's career advice that I give to every one of my students who comes in for career guidance. He said, it's a fundamental mistake to market yourself based on your experience, because then you're just applying for the last job you had. Instead, you need to market yourself based on your ability. And the experience is a very slight proxy for your ability. But find other ways to demonstrate your ability, and people will want to do business with you because of what you can do, not because of what you have done. And that gave me essentially the courage to take that big leap 38 years ago and to go work in business to do applied ethics for business. But that has also given me the ability to redirect my path when I saw something that seemed more rewarding and more gratifying, but that I'd never done before. For example, you know, I was in the late 1980s, the head of all corporate communication at the third largest investment bank in the world. I was scared, you know, do I have the capacity to do that? But because I didn't have the experience of managing big teams, I was worried that could I really do it? But I had the ability to at least figure things out. So I took the leap and it worked out very, very well. So it's that ability experience dichotomy that I think we need to keep present.
Well, that is excellent advice that we're all going to think about. And Fred, just last question, super easy. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and your books?
Well, thank you. That's very kind. The books are all on Amazon and other platforms like BNN, and they're around the world. You can get them anywhere in the world through an Amazon-like place. The Power of Communication was translated into Chinese, and it's available in China in Chinese. My book Reputation Management was translated into Korean, and you can find it in Korea. The Agony of Decision and Power of Communication are easily available as ebooks as well as hard books. Reputation Management is also an ebook, but it's a very long ebook. I am on Twitter at GarciaHF. I blog, and you can subscribe to my blog at logosconsulting.net and just click on the blog page. And I'm always out in the world writing, talking, teaching, and I invite people to be in a relationship.
Excellent. And we are certainly watching and thankful for everything that you're doing. Fred, thank you. You've shared a lot of valuable information, given us a lot to think about, and super helpful advice so that we can be mentally ready for tough decisions. So thank you for taking the time to come on Women Worldwide. We really appreciate you.
Thank you so much.
And I also want to thank all of you for tuning into Women Worldwide. And if you have a moment, please go and rate Women Worldwide on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback. Okay, friends, until our next episode, let's stay energized, focused, and feeling empowered. Thank you.